Now, Jim, you mentioned the route that you were taking out to the Pacific, and did you fly any of that, or were you a cargo?
Cargo.
Okay. And
on a C-54.
And your crew was with you,
mm-hmm.
and were you all understanding that you would fly together as a crew? There was that integration had already occurred. Okay. Can you tell me about the guys that were in your crew that at that time and their names, if you can
okay.
remember?
Sure. My co-pilot was from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He was still second lieutenant, and he had come from B-17s into the B-29 program. I was about probably, this is 44, I was 25.
All of 25?
45, yes, before. And he was still 21-ish.
He was only, he were the old man, and he was just a nipper.
The old man.
Okay.
And then we had...
tell you his name.
No, his name was Francis Thompson.
Thompson, okay.
From Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I'll just go back through the airplane rather than
sure. try
to, we had, but I will tell you, we had 5 officers and 6 enlisted men.
Right.
And the engineer was a tech sergeant. His name was Donald Lieber, and I think he was originally from California. And then the next one would be my navigator, who was first lieutenant Eugene Victor from New York City,
mm-hmm.
and my radio operator was Ernest Vick, who was probably 19, and he was from LJ, Georgia. Now, that's all of the people in the front cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had, in the pressurized compartment, we had a long tube over the bomb bays and went back to the gunner compartment. That was pressurized, too. And in the gunner compartment, the CFC gunner originally was John Keogh, and he was a staff sergeant from Wallingford, Connecticut. My right gunner was Donald Comer from Birmingham, Alabama, probably 19 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
My left gunner was Marvin Beatty, who was from Rochester, New York, and he was probably 23. He was next to me as being the old man on the crew. Our initial radar operator, was a first lieutenant named John Siegel, and he was from Chicago. He sat just in the compartment, just aft of the gunner's compartment.
Okay.
That was a radar station. And also had a storage place in the same compartment. And then that's the end of the pressurized area, except they had a tube that went on back to the tail gunner's compartment, a small tube about so big to pressurize it.
Okay.
And he would have to crawl through an open area.
I've seen that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
His name was John Terrell, and he was 19, and he was from New York City. And when we got to Guam, we were met by a 6x6 truck and all loaded on it, and it took us up to what we call the bivouac area, and then just huge berms of jungle just been bulldozed out,
mm-hmm.
and nothing but red dirt all around. We had about 3 wooden type buildings with screens on them that were headquarters, operations, and a dining hall. And they pulled us up in front of a big pile of canvas and says, "That's your tent. When you pitch it, you have a place to sleep tonight." All 11 of us. And where are the cots? They said, "You have your sleeping bag on the ground."
Wow. And that's it.
So we got busy, pitched our tent,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know how long it was. But after a couple of 3 weeks or something like that. They came to us and said, okay, you officers, we have some Quonset huts back down here that need to be built. If you want to move out of here and go build your Quonset hut, then you, in between missions, you can go down there and build your Quonset hut. But the enlisted men, well, we got cops before we left.
Okay. We got, so you're off the ground at least.
So the enlisted men still stayed in those tents, but we officers joined with another crew. We put two crews on Quonset and built our Quonset hut. And it was nice. It was nice. Believe me.
It was better than the ground. And
how many
crews were there? Were guys coming in as you were?
Some of them had gotten there before us, but some of them, well, and then we were the last ones there.
You were about the last ones?
Initial crews, yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Then we'd get a replacement crews later. And I don't remember exactly how many crews to a group now. We had three squadrons to the group. We had the 30th Bomb Squadron, 28th Bomb Squadron, 93rd Bomb Squadron. And if I remember correctly, we each had 11 airplanes, each squadron. And we had a flight leader who, in our case, was a major, an aircraft commander. And we would always fly on daylight missions. We would fly the nine-ship formation in elements of three in a V type. And I was, after about the second mission, I became an element leader of the right-hand element, from flying on the right wing of the forward three echelon.
How soon after you got to Guam did you start to fly missions?
I got to Guam I think it was 25th of February, something like that. And I flew my first mission, I believe it was the 6th or 9th of March.
Okay, so about a month?
About 10 days.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe 11, something like that.
And what did they tell you about your missions?
We always had, a mission briefing, very detailed mission briefing about the target, what we could expect in the way of anti-aircraft, what we might expect in fighters, the forecast weather, which was very unreliable because there were no reporting stations west of Japan, and it was just kind of a guess on the weatherman's part. And we would be briefed on the type bomb we were carrying, the type target we were going to hit, and the purpose of the type bomb for the target. And that was just about it for the briefing. It usually took about 30, 40 minutes for this total briefing. And then we would be put on trucks and taken to our airplane and do our pre-flight. And when our engine start time, about 10 minutes before engine start time, we'd all be in our seats ready to fire up. Then we get fired up, taxi out, and just have a long stream of airplanes down the taxiway, taking off 30-second intervals. And at the end of the runway, there would be an operations officer with a green light gun, and when it was our turn to release our brakes, he'd put a yellow light on. That means we'd come up to full power.
Okay.
And he'd turn the green light on, and we'd release our brakes and go.
And he's standing there with this device, like a gun almost, that had
just a light,
some kind of a light on the end of it.
Yeah.
And about how far away is he standing from
He's standing off
from
the edge of the runway, probably. Just probably 100 feet from where we were.
And is he getting this radio? Is he getting radio signals?
Mm-hmm.
And does he have headphones on and so
on?
On
the tower. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Jim, this is a very important thing that you're telling us about. So, and of course, any details you want to pitch in, very interesting.
Your crew chief. Tell her about your crew chief, Cecil. You didn't mention him.
Now this is the ground group.
Very important man in my life.
Well, okay.
Oh yes, ma'am.
Okay, before our first mission, I was given my airplane, our crew airplane. Each we flew the same airplane every mission, as long as it's in commission to fly. And
the crew would stay together. They would stay with an aircraft. And did you stay with a ground crew and a crew chief?
We didn't stay with them. They were separate from our air crew.
Okay, right.
In bivouac area. But our air crew worked closely with them in the aircraft preparation.
Okay.
If, for example, the ground crew chief consisted of five people, had a crew chief before. And if it got beyond their capability, they had what you call crew maintenance.
Sure. Okay.
But our air crew would come down after they got their rest, come down and assist in doing various things. The armament section, the bomb section would come down and load the bombs for us for whatever the type mission was. The ground crew did not assist, but they were not responsible for loading them. That's a technique in itself to make sure that they're properly engaged there, so that when the bombardier flicks a switch,
it
will open them.
And not before.
Yeah.
Not any other time. Yeah, sure.
So that was the coordination she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I, just as she said, I give Cecil Corley, my chief, ground crew chief, a great bit of the responsibility for being here today, because he took such good care of the airplane.
We still are friends.
Yeah, we still have dinner and lunch with him once every 3 or 4 months.
Does he live down in the Dallas area then?
They
Fort Worth?
In Greenville.
Okay.
They live in Dallas.
75 miles from where we are.
And so you still see him?
Call him, talk to him.
How wonderful. That's really, really special.
I thank him every time I see him.
I still have two crew members that are still alive that I keep in touch with. Two air crew members.
Mm-hmm.
My last bombardier, we changed a few people. My last bombardier and my original co-pilot, but he is so ill. He's just hardly hanging on.
Where does he live?
He lives right now there in Spokane, Washington.
Okay.
And my bombardier lives in the winters in Las Vegas, and in the summers in Smithfield, Michigan.
Now,
I was going to say, I think I took better care of him. He was the old man on the crew, and most of them are gone.
I guess you did a pretty good job, Minnie Mae. I'm going to say he's in fine shape. Well, so you had a very close working relationship, which I'm sure you cultivated with those guys on the ground crew. You've described the flight, the pattern that you were in. How many missions did you fly? Let's start there.
35.
Okay, and that was what you had to fly in order to rotate out, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Did you ever encounter fighter aircraft, Japanese fighter aircraft?
Let me go back a little bit.
Sure.
We got the green light for takeoff.
Sure.
I don't remember now the length of the runway. Off the top of my head, I think maybe 8,500 feet. Not extremely long like we have today.
Right.
A B-29 was originally designed for a max gross load of 120,000 pounds. We were flying 135,000, some 38,000.
Because of how much?
How much fuel, how many bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And the stalling speed of the airplane was just about the same number of miles per hour as the gross weight. 135,000 pounds, 135 miles an hour.
Okay.
So you want to be above 135 miles an hour before you roll ground. A lot of the pilots thought that meant that you break ground at 135. Well, taken off at Guam, Northfield, Guam. There were three Air Force airports on Guam. One was Harmon Field in the middle of the island where the transport airplanes came in.
Okay.
No combat there.
Uh-huh.
And then the other was Northwest Field where the 315th bomb wing was. They had a special mission we weren't involved in. The 314th wing that the 19th bomb group was in is Northfield.
Mm-hmm.
So our runway started out with a little bit of a slope down, and then it had a little swell, and then just a little bit of an uprise on the far end for takeoff.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, they had several hundred yards, 400 or 500 yards, of the jungle cleared away in case you had to skid through them. But there was still, from the end of the runway to the edge of the cliff of Guam was roughly a little over a quarter of a mile, maybe as much as a half mile anyway, some closer, with jungle beyond that cleared part on over to the edge, 600 foot cliff. So what we were always worried about was losing an engine on takeoff. If we did that, there was no way, hardly any way, you were going to survive getting over that jungle and be able to dive down. We had many crashes into that jungle.
You did?
The loss of engine crash.
Why were the engines coming away on takeoff?
A lot of times an engine just go out just for no given reason. It just quits.
So it would just quit. It wouldn't actually come away from the craft.
It wouldn't fall off.
It would just die.
It might internally come off.
Right.
I mean, come apart internally.
Right. Just not functioning.
Yeah. But anyway, I told my crew, I said, that the end of that runway is hardtop, and beyond that is a little bit of coral, and then it's just nothing but dirt. But the end of that runway is where the nose wheels are going to come off the ground. I'm going to get as much speed as I can, which was usually around 150 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So in case I lost an engine, I had 150 miles an hour to hopefully sustain.
Get up.
And a lot of my contemporary aircraft commander says, why are you doing that? I said, here's the reason, as I just explained.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that seems to make sense. Maybe we won't pull it off. We won't pull that nose wheel up so soon. But after we got to the edge of the cliff and dove down at 600 feet, almost 600 feet, we had good airspeed then, could go.
And you could get going. Mm-hmm.
And we had two different type missions. We had daylight formation missions. We had nighttime single aircraft missions. But before we got there, the 93rd bomb wing over on Saipan, which is 125 miles closer to Japan than we were, had a lot of trouble at altitude hitting their targets, because if they bombed from west to east, had a bombing run from west to east. A bombing run consists of a point called an initial point. You fly to that point and then you start your run to the target, and that run is where you've got to hold that airplane straight and level at a certain altitude for an airspeed for that bombardier to get his bomb sight working correctly, Norden bomb sight.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where my training bombardier cadets came in.
Okay.
I had to do that for them to get their accuracy on their training bombs, so I was pretty adept at it. Anyway.
So it came back and paid off for you?
It paid off, yeah. That's why I made the comment it did way back.
Absolutely.
The 93rd had found that going from west to east, the airplane had a ground speed. Do you understand ground speed?
Why don't you explain it, just in case someone listening doesn't?
Ground speed is the speed that the airplane actually moves across the ground, always in the air.
Yes.
Across the ground. And that consists of the speed the airplane says it's going on its airspeed indicator, plus the wind it may have from the tail, or the wind it may have from the nose, or side wind to, if it's to go on nosewise, that wind will slow it down.
Right.
The ground speed, that is, may read 200 miles an hour on your airspeed indicator. If you have a 30 mile an hour headwind, you're going under 70 miles an hour across the ground.
Got it.
Same with the rear. If you have a tailwind 30 miles an hour, you're going 230. Mm-hmm. They found they were going at their bombing speed, which was between 210 and 260 airspeed. They were fine. They were going almost 350 miles an hour. Ground speed, and the bombardier just couldn't synchronize.
I imagine.
Doing too fast.
Nobody knew anything about a, quote, jet stream in those days. That was the first indication aviation had of jet streams.
Is that right?
That's right. So, General LeMay came over from England.
Curtis LeMay.
Curtis LeMay. And he says, guys, we ain't hacking it. We're going to change things. If we get good forecasts on weather and they can tell me that the wind probably aren't blowing too strong, we may fly daylight formation at high altitude bombing, which we did on several mini missions. Or we're going to go in where we can really put the bombs on the target between 5,000 and 12,000 feet at night, single ship. And boy, we pilot, we air crew said, wait a minute, in our mind and in our private conversation, never questioned the
money.
In our minds, we said, man, they flew a single, get us there. Well, fortunately, they're an aircraft. They didn't have very many automated aircraft. I say a radar aircraft, but it's all automated for 20 to 25,000 feet, calibrated for that type of thing. So, fortunately, we're moving fast enough, they couldn't quite. It wasn't as, the anti-aircraft fire wasn't as hectic at those low altitudes as we had anticipated. But the thermal clouds that were generated by preceding bomb drops, those clouds were the most horrendous thing I've ever been in my life. The fire, first of all, the night missions were primarily incendiary bomb missions. And we burned out huge parts of various cities around the factories. And the primary reason around the factories was because the Japanese would contract out, or maybe not contract, but specify, you have a sewing machine, you're going to do this kind of job, you have an electric saw, you're going to do this in homes. So there was compassionate feeling on our part, young guys, about letting those homes burn outside of the factory complex itself.
So you were thinking that these, although their description might be civilian, that in fact they were part of the war effort.
That was our briefing, okay. And that was LeMay's concept.
And you guys all pretty much accepted that and felt that was probably correct.
Correct.
Okay, so you didn't. So emotionally, you were okay.
Had no emotion about it.
Okay, so there wasn't any emotion.
Because what we had heard of the atrocities on the islands and all, and that POWs were getting, we could hear about. We had no
compunction about doing this. Okay. So the incendiary missions are clouds.
Incendiaries would cause huge clouds. And if there was not a huge wind to move that cloud away from the target complex, and it just came up, we had to go through that cloud, put our bombs close to the target at least. And once you got in that thing, you were hoping that you'd come out the right side up.
Because you had no way to check your...
The only way was our instruments.
So you're flying only instruments.
Only instruments.
Okay.
And, but... up or down and sideways, and
rough.
The bombardier or the radar operator, bombardier couldn't see anything, so the radar operator was one, it was zero again on the target area where the bombardier would drop the bombs. That that was the worst environment I've ever been in, including severe thunderstorms. That in fact, on one mission, my CFC gunner's pedestal that he sat in his rotating seat, that came loose from the floor of the airplane. It didn't hurt him, fortunately, but it came loose. We used to lose a lot of rivets in airplanes bouncing around like that with wings.
Now, the bouncing, was that because of the different pressures inside and outside the clouds? Mm-hmm. And so you're just getting banged all of them.
See, when these clouds come up, they swirl like this. So on this side, you may go up. This side, you're going down. Just swirling
so
like that.
It would really toss you around.
Oh, really?
And you're in formation.
No, single ship.
No, this is single ship. Okay.
But another sweat on that was we had an exact time, exact altitude to be over that target. If this guy up here is early, he drops his bombs, and here I come. The possibility of him, we never did have this occur, but it was always a big sweat. And no one, I shouldn't say no one, there were many, many that never did make it exactly on time, and either before or early or late over the target. But we, to my knowledge, we never did lose an airplane by friendly drone.
Now, I have seen the photographs taken from inside the B-29 flying in formation with the bombs raining from all of the aircraft at the same time, and I think that's what you're describing.
No, that's daylight.
Oh, that's with the formation bombs.
Yeah, that's daylight formation.
Okay, so with the single mission bombs, single plane missions, you might be on one, someone else might be simultaneously also on a single plane mission flying to a point.
Lots of them.
Like how many in
that?
Say with one major city area.
One major city, probably over 150 airplanes.
Oh my gosh.
But it'll start at midnight,
mm-hmm.
and then every 3 minutes or every 2 minutes or something, right. another airplane's there, another, so forth.
Now
it would take a long time for the whole mission to be complete,
right,
over the target.
Right, because they're coming in mm-hmm. in this kind of graduated way,
yeah.
incrementally. Where was a mission like that planned? Was there a headquarters on Guam itself mm-hmm. that was making all of those design decisions?
Right. General May's headquarters was on Guam,
okay.
21st Bomber Command,
mm-hmm.
under the 20th Air Force. And his staff would plan the whole mission, and each wing would get their requirement, and then it'd be passed down to the group for our participation in it. And but everything was outlined, our takeoff time over target, altitude, fly, everything was all already prepared for us.
Now, of your 35 missions, how many were those nighttime missions, can you guess?
You know, I could count in my diary. I kept a diary. I don't know whether I sent you one or not. No, I didn't, because it didn't involve Vietnam.
Well,
but I kept a diary of that, so I could count that up. I would say probably 69, 40 days. That's just off the top of my head.
Now, from a pilot's perspective, which would you rather fly? Which did you feel better flying? The nighttime single missions?
Daylight formations.
I guess I have to say, knowing nothing about it, I would too. But can you go ahead and just take us through why that would be the case? It's sort of evident, but go ahead and just tell us.
Well, be the case, it's daylight. You can see all around you. Problem was, in daylight you get the fighters, but not in dark. But you just had the feeling of camaraderie with 9 airplanes that you're a part of,
right.
And you know this guy's leading this one, I'm leading this one, you know this guy's leading this one, you know they're wingmen, and
And you're together.
Yeah. What you can expect of each one. Mm-hmm. And on that type mission, the lead ship is the lead bombardier, and the rest of the ones are just toggle, what we call toggle, on the first bomb they saw come out of the lead airplane. Toggle means they flick a switch and our bomb would go at the same time. If it was set up on an intervalometer, the bomb would drop here, then we'd have the same intervalometer setting back here on the bombardier's panel. And but if it was just a mass drop, the lead plane just with all the others, and that's what you've been seeing mostly, I think.
Uh-huh.
The pictures I've
those
seen
photographs,
there,
yeah,
looks like just mass instead of interferometer. Let's see another one. Oh, about the fighters. When we first started flying in March, we didn't have any fighter support for ourselves, but I've forgotten now what month, but sometime probably in late April or early May, Iwo Jima became secure enough that they moved in a fighter wing there, P-51s, and they had I think it was 3 B-29 navigate motherships for them, they called them. And based on what the mission was, daylight mission was, these B-29s would take off, the fighters would take off, and this mothership would lead them to the target area that each group of 51s were assigned to protect. And then the mothership would head back to Iwo, and the fighters would do their thing with Japanese fighters.
Mm-hmm.
If there weren't too many of them, they'd go down and do their work on the ground, and then they'd come back up, and after we finished our bomb run, they'd hook on to one of our airplanes, which went right over Iwo anyway, and just fly formation until we got to Iwo, and then they would
out. Drop out.
Uh-huh. And we had a procedure. They looked a P-51 silhouette. Looks much like a Japanese Tony. It was hard for a gunner to determine which was which. So we had a procedure that the 51 never did come toward to hook onto you like this.
Oh.
They came like this and kind of slid over like this with the nose still pointing
friendly.
Away.
So the silhouette would look different?
That's right. So we knew it was friendly rather than coming at us.
Jeez.
But there were some P-51s that got friendly fire on them. Not shot down, but got friendly fire.
Yeah, hard. Right.
Hey, guy.
I bet there was some radio traffic over that. I can only imagine. Now, let's talk about the night missions a little bit more. Did you did you know of ground-based anti-aircraft fire on during those night missions?
I never did.
By March of 1945?
Never did have. To my knowledge, I don't remember anyone ever reporting damage from ground fire.
I mean, that's really extraordinary.
Really?
That tells you.
There were probably some, but I didn't hear about it. I never did.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was because they couldn't aim at us directly. They couldn't see us.
So there still were your briefing? Did your briefings provide information that there was active anti-aircraft defenses in Japan, but they just didn't couldn't reach you?
The briefings always say what intelligence would tell them.
Sure.
That there was this, you could expect this many anti-aircraft batteries around a given target.
Uh-huh.
Let's see, there's another point I was going to make right there.
It'll come back to you, I'm sure. At nighttime, did you ever, any of your missions or ones that you heard about, get that enemy fighter interference?
No, not that I know of.
Man, that's just incredible.
We would get searchlights until we got in the cloud.
Uh-huh.
And searchlights were a big psychological effect on us.
What can you describe that?
Well, my very first mission was a nighttime mission, but it was a high altitude before I made did this other. And we were left IP, headed toward target in Nagoya. I don't remember the name of the aircraft factory.
Mm-hmm.
And about halfway to the target, about three searchlights got us. And man, you talk about bright in the cockpit.
Oh.
And it was scary. But we kept going straight. My bombardier got real upset.
Mm-hmm.
He was just excited.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he didn't even release the bombs over the target.
Because he was rattled by it.
So, yeah. So I said, we're going to make a 360.
Oh, gosh.
So I come back, second time over the target. Vern Davis was his name. And, wait a minute, I didn't mention him.
No, it was your first one.
I didn't even mention Bombardier earlier. Vern Davis from somewhere in New York, northern New York, was my first bombardier.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, Vern, and I said to the whole crew, hey,
sure.
Guys, we're going to make another run. We didn't drop our bombs. So we did. But the second time, the lights got us again, and they stayed with us all the way over the target. And man, once those bombs were out of the bomb bay, I made a diving turn and got out of the lights in a hurry, and then everything settled down.
Wow.
They were real psychological minutes.
Absolutely.
Once they got you, because you knew if they got you that the anti-aircraft guns could see you.
Could train on you. They could train on you. But that didn't, I mean, for you that did not follow.
Well, it's on the lower altitude missions. Mm-hmm. It did. This was high.
This is how high were you?
Oh, we were probably 22,000, somewhere in that, 25,000.
It's still extraordinary that that the lights were powerful enough.
Oh yeah.
And I could see how that would rattle your cage a little bit. Actually, more.
I might say in that respect, mentioning altitude.
Sure.
I mentioned earlier about being pressurized.
Yes.
We never did go over the target pressurized. We always went over the target with our oxygen masks on.
And can you explain why that was?
Yes, because if we got a hit in a pressurized compartment, we might have explosive decompression and we're gone. So being unpressurized over the target with our escape hatches open so we could bail out if we had a problem. And, but then once we left, the homeland of Japan got out over the ocean, we went back to pressurization.
How long did the pressurization and depressurization process take?
When you once
you just
you turn it off, it goes down almost immediately.
Right away? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So there wasn't any gradualization there?
It might take 3 or 4, 5 minutes, something.
Okay,
like
at that. Most. Okay. Who was responsible for making that
the flight
transition
engineer on my command.
Mm-hmm. And did you get to decide who on the aircraft? Was that something that you as the pilot had discretion over? Which member of the crew would take care of that, the pressurization issue?
No.
Or was that standard operating?
Our co-pilot and he had a switch that would turn off the compressor.
Okay.
It was the aircraft commander's responsibility to determine when that would be done, unless there was an emergency.
Right.
Emergencies, a flight engineer automatically turned it off.
Okay.
He didn't have anything to do except monitor the whole airplane, whole array of instruments and switches and all, plus the pilot, co-pilot had to worry about
a few other things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was his duty as a basic item.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there any mission that you remember particularly that you can share, or more than one?
In fact, my navigator was quite a writer.
A writer. Okay.
He wrote up an overview of this particular mission.
Okay.
A wonderful overview. He started with the time we'd wake up, the briefing, go down to the airplane, get the airplane ready, pull the propellers through, get in, start number one, number two, and so forth. Detail, right on up through the whole mission, come back landing and off. Reminding us in your
heart. Oh, that's a wonderful.
Yes, please.
It's wonderful.
Okay. How a mission goes. But anyway, this particular mission was a formation over Osaka, Japan. And in, I think it was 6th of June, but anyway, it was in June of 45. And I was we were in our 9-ship formation, 19 bomb group. And I mean the 30th squadron of the 19th bomb group. And I was a number 2 element leader. And after we left the IP en route to the target over Osaka, my right wing man called and said, "Jim, I've just lost an engine. I think it's number 4, but that's immaterial. I've just lost an engine. I can't keep up." And we had fighters. So I said to the flight leader, the number 1 element, I forgot what his name, Tobin, I think his name was, I said, "Tobin, number 1 or whatever," I said, "I've got to drop back and give Larned the extra firepower that we can afford to give him in a 2-ship formation rather than a 3-ship, rather than a single ship formation with the fighters, he'll knock him down."
Now these are Japanese enemy fighters. Okay.
And we didn't have E-51s in the air for some reason.
Okay. On this mission, you had no cover? You guys had no? Okay, no fighter cover.
So I told my left wing man to join up under the lead element. And I asked Larned what airspeed he could hold, and he told me not to pull back. And we flew formation to 2-ship formation, and the fighters just came after us like wasps. And a little anti-aircraft fire also. We both dropped our bombs on target. We continued on target. And then after target, we peeled away. And that's when the fighters really began to get us. And my airplane I had over 60 holes in it. And one of them was through the top part of the center fuselage going down and out the far side of the bomb bay, about this big around, and through the tube that we would crawl through from the front compartment to the aft compartment, and out of the other 60 holes just all over the airplane. And Larned got quite a few too, but we got him back to Iwo Jima. He landed there to get repairs, and then we went on home. But that was the mission that was most outstanding. I got to the FC for that.
Jim, can you tell me about the tactics that you used and the tactics that the enemy used? How did you? Why did you not get shot down?
Well,
truly.
Well,
good flying.
No.
Good equipment.
Good airplane.
Yes, ma'am.
We stayed basic.
I think you're right.
No evasive action.
None.
No, not on the IP especially. Because you got to give the bombardier that stable platform.
That's right.
And regardless of what happens outside that airplane, he's got to be able to synchronize that bomb sight so that the bombs will hit the target, and you don't do anything except fly straight and level.
You as the pilot prioritize the dropping of the bombs over evasive action, regardless of the.
That's right. It's just the gunners, and our. Support airplanes on our other wing, on the other wings. It all helps. Once you're in a 9-ship formation, you got terrific firepower against fighters, but they'll sneak in on you. The first fighter I ever remember seeing was coming in from 10 o'clock low, and I saw these little pink specks. And I thought, that looks just like a movie. And then I thought, hey, this is real. I got my armor. Vest down over me and all. I called in the fighter 10 o'clock. Well, the bombardier shot him down. Thank goodness.
Did shoot him down.
Yeah.
And did you see that happen? Were you watching that?
I was watching that. Yeah.
Can you describe what you saw?
Well, the bombardier saw him about the same time I did, I guess, because all of a sudden, just nothing but a ball of fire out there. After I first saw those little pink things, then he just peeled down. He was a good way from us when he was shooting at us.
How close?
He probably didn't get within maybe 7,500 yards of us. When he exploded.
100 yards?
100 yards. That
feels close.
Pretty close. we bet him come through the formation, either already shot, the powder already shot up coming through the formation, and in some cases hitting an airplane or luckily missing the whole thing.
Uh-huh. But that close.
No. But after we leave the bombing target, then we kind of loosen up a little bit in our formation.
Mm-hmm.
Formation flying is very precise. I don't know. What you do is you get a point on my airplane and a point on the airplane you're flying a wing on, and you line those two points up. And if one point starts moving a little forward, you're gaining. You pull back on the throttle just a little bit, and it stabilizes, so those two points stay right together.
Mm-hmm. And you were doing this all visually. Of course, this isn't how it's done anymore. But
that's right.
But you were just doing this by reckoning, by just visual reckoning.
Visual reckoning, yeah.
Tell me about landing from that mission. Your compatriot in the other plane landed at Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. You flew on back to Guam?
Yeah, after we left after the group left the homeland of Japan, we were each on our own to get back home.
Yeah.
The engineering section of the group gives us a proposed altitude to fly and a proposed power setting to, depending on the fuel load. And if your fuel is running low, you run a little slower so you don't burn it quite as fast.
Right.
But you still, in other words, you don't use as much fuel.
Right.
So it's up to the pilot then to make that decision so we'd be on our own.
Now, when you brought the aircraft in, of course, you didn't know it had 60 holes, but you probably could guess you had a few.
Had a bunch.
Any hydraulics problems while you were landing or anything like that?
No.
So all of your flaps and everything were functional.
Fortunately.
And your aircraft and your landing gear.
Yeah.
No problems. And so you just put it down in a beautiful landing.
Yeah.
Boy.
We knew we had holes because the gunners would tell us your right wing had. I can see. such and such, and then we knew that big holes through the center there because it was open
draft, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how big was that hole?
No, it's probably 14-16 inches, something like that. Through the skin of the fuselage, and then it decreased in the tube because it had maybe 10 feet to go after it exploded here. And then tore into the tube and tore into the far side of the tube.
Now, did you guys all go and have a beer after that, or what?
I bought a drinker.
Okay.
In fact,
that was a good thing, probably.
Speaking of that, after every combat mission, and after we landed, we'd get off and be taken back up to the intelligence briefing.
Yes.
Hut. But outside that, there'd be a table and Red Cross girls behind it and serve you a little shot of whiskey.
Okay.
Kind of calm you down when you went for intelligence for debriefing. And all my guys would fight to see who got behind me, to see who got second.
Because you were going to go right past that. And I'll bet they did.
And the same way we officers, this is the way officers say, we officers would get. We're allowed one bottle of liquor every week.
Huh?
And I didn't drink, so I'd always give that to my enlisted crew because they didn't get it. And one of my other officers also didn't drink. And but the enlisted crew really they'd share it with the ground crew. So they had a good camaraderie there.
Yeah, that was a very
but,
good thing to do as a
coming command. Back from a mission like that, after we landed, everything's fine. Yeah. We're happy.
I'll bet you. Did you mention your flag?
Cecil Corley, my ground crew chief's mother, sent him a Texas flag.
Okay.
And he put it on a broomstick. And he came to me and he said, Lieutenant, would you fly this flag out to the window of your airplane on taxi? And then after you land, slow down enough, open your window and do that again. I said, well, hope I can do that. I'll be busy flying. I mean, landing and taking off and on. I mean, taxiing. So every mission, my co-pilot would hoist that Texas flag out the co-pilot's window. From the time we left the hard stand down the taxiway until he had to close his window to take off. And then he'd give it back to the engineer and he'd fold it up, roll it up, hide it somewhere. When we got down and landed, slowed down enough to end the runway that he could open his window again, here came the Texas flag. And that flag is now in the Frontiers Flight Museum in Buffield.
Is it really?
It's not on display.
Now, did Mr. Corley give that to them?
No, gave it to, originally. Well, originally. There's a after War II. This is way well
said. That's okay.
After
there's
War
no such
II,
thing, really.
The 19th bomber. Well, no, not after War II. Going way back from the 19th history now. They were at Clark Field on December the 7th, 1941.
The 19th bomber was?
19th bomber and B-17s.
Yes.
Early B-17s, not the ones like they saw over Europe.
Right.
And on December the 8th, 1941, which was December the 7th, Pearl Harbor, the Japanese bombed Clark Field 2 hours after they bombed Pearl Harbor. And they tore up a lot of the 19th airplanes there. Eventually, the 19th was evacuated from there with whatever they could and took MacArthur to Australia.
Yes, sir.
And then they flew out of Australia, moved up to Java a while, got run out of there, and then bombed around. Then they came back in late 42, I think it was, to Pauk Army Airfield, which is about roughly 100 miles west of Midland, Texas. And they did combat crew training there for a while, and then they were deactivated and became the 19 bomb group, very heavy for B-29s in mid-1944. And then when they got to Great Bend then in early August, maybe late July, they began to accumulate all the air crews. But the B-17 crews at Pio did not go to Great Bend.
Okay, and so the flag that got put it at Love Field.
It started out that later after War II. Now, because there had been the 19th at Pyle, the Ward County Commissioner decided to make one of his commissioners for that particular precinct decided to make a museum of the history of Ward County. And in addition to the building that she had for that, there was a lot of extra room. She had a good friend in Monahans, which is 16 miles away, that had a big army, a big military collection. And she asked him to put the military collection in there. And a lot of it was from the 19th days when they were piled. So our 19th Bombardment Association, is active today. We have annual reunions.
Sure.
Decided to make that the repository for anything any of our people want to send to it. So the flag went to Pyle first. But this little museum is only open on the weekends.
Sure.
And Pyle now is a little town of about 300 people. And no signage on Interstate 20 that comes right through the middle of Pyle. Now, saying there's a museum there.
Right.
So everything that's in that museum is just kind of stagnant. And I went to the county commissioner, who we became pretty good friends.
Sure.
And I said, you know, I'm going to take that flag out of here. She said, I don't blame you. Take it and go.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept it in my garage until a couple, 3 months ago, when Frontiers of Flight built a brand new museum on Littlefield.
Right. I haven't been there yet, but I hear it's something else.
It's pretty good. They've got a lot of building, a lot of things to do on it yet.
Oh, sure.
But I took that plus several other artifacts over there.
You asked Cecil if he wanted the flag.
Yeah, oh yeah. I asked Cecil a long time ago. He says, no, Jim. He says, my kids don't want it. And I don't have the means for it. And I said, well, I don't need it. He says, hanging on my garage wall. It's all framed, glass and all.
Yeah.
But they did that at Pyle. But, so I donated that along with some other memorabilia.
Did you tell her about Big Fowler writing up about your flag in the paper in the Dallas News? I mean, was the Times here?
Well, during War II, Wong Kwan, the Dallas Morning News had a war reporter over there named Wick Fowler, famous for his chili cook-offs down in Terlingua.
Oh, I think I've heard.
Yeah,
okay, uh-huh. He was on Guam.
Yeah,
okay.
He came over there. And he got wind of this Texas flag, so he came up and talked to Cecil Corley, who was at the airplane all the time when he was on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And he talked to him, and they got me down there and holding the flag out the window,
taking
pictures.
Yeah.
So it was in the paper, big write-up.
Texan does this. Rook cranked Cecil into it because he was a Texan too.
So. Well, sure. And he's the one who had the flag, right?
Yeah.
He's now, let me ask you, I like the flag story very much. Did you have a name for your aircraft?
City of Flatbush.
The City of Flatbush? How'd that come about?
Well, here's a story on that. Most all wartime airplanes, and Gurley knows Arnold.
They sure did.
Mm-hmm. Our wing commander, General Powers at the time, Tommy Powers, said, on Guam, said, any of your airplanes in this wing that have Gurley, that have nose art on them, eradicated. We're going to do something positive for the war effort. We're going to name every airplane in this wing after some city in the United States. You aircraft commanders put in your request for a city. So, being from Dallas, and my crew agreed, Dallas. We put in a request for Dallas. It had already been assigned.
Oh, okay.
Then they said, well, take Minnie Mae's home, Irving. Well, Irving had already been assigned. So, yeah. So we said, where do we go from here? My navigator, Brooklyn, New York.
I remember you saying that.
Says, well, let's name it Flatbush. What is Flatbush?
Now, was this Eugene? What was his name?
Eugene
Victor.
Victor. He said, let's name it Flatbush. Well, all of us little young dummies didn't know what Flatbush was. He said, that's a nickname for Brooklyn. So he said, oh, well, I need to regress. The object of this whole program was, name your airplane. We'll write a nice letter to the mayor. In this case, it would be a borough president, whatever you call him, or mayor of New York, whichever. And in my case, it's the mayor of New York. And we'll send this letter to them and say, here's what we've done to advertise your city. And what we want you to do is get some publicity on this and say, hey, folks, here's a B-29 named after our city. Go out and buy some war bonds to help support this war effort. Build another B-29.
Smart. Very smart.
And so the city of Flatbush, that's how the city of Flatbush came about. And we got a nice letter back from whoever was the mayor then. I've looked at the copy of that.
Can't find it.
Now, did the plane get decorated at all? Did it have City of Flatbush written on it?
Oh, well, yes, I'm sorry. In a big circle It had the North American continent on it.
Okay.
Canada, Alaska, United States, Mexico, Central America. None of those were named. And the U.S. wasn't named, but it was a different color. And wherever that city was in the United States, a pennant pole went down. That came out, and a little streamer pennant came out of the city of Flatbush.
Now, who did the art, do you know?
Had several artists that could do that.
This was all sort of centrally organized by the squadron? By the wing. By the wing,
Wing commander said, I want all you girly artists to come see me, and here's what we're going to do.
I wasn't here as much fun.
It's easy to find girly artists.
Well, I'm glad to have that story.
That sure is far away from Vietnam.
Yeah, that's all right. We're getting there. We're making good progress. You mentioned in the notes that you provided that your last mission was at the end of July, 1945. Now, let me ask: how did you feel at that point? What were you thinking about how long the war might go on, just given what you were seeing as a pilot?
On my 35th mission, it was my crew's 34th mission.
Okay.
Because I had to fly an orientation mission with another crew on my very first mission without any of my crew on.
Okay. So you were one up on that.
And I was planning to fly my 36th mission with my crew. But the wing had a policy, 35 missions, and that's it. And I went to my squadron commander, and he said, oh, we can arrange that. And then he went to the group commander and says, here's the situation. And the group commander said, okay, we'll do that. But the wing flight surgeon came in and said, whoops, sorry. He might psychologically be unable to continue to complete that mission because it's an extra mission. I can't let him fly that extra mission.
Now, that doesn't sound like it had anything to do with you or an evaluation of you. It was just a statement.
It might be. So, very sadly, I didn't get to fly my crew on their 35th mission, which was about 4 days later than my July 29th. And I sweated it out. They had a brand new aircraft commander from other 10 crew members. And I really worried about
him. You worried about him.
And Cecil Corley and I, well, after they took off, we went back. It's a bump time because it's a 16, 17, 18 hour mission. And we rested, when it was about time to get back down there, I was back down there to meet them. And it was happy with Katie because they called him Milk Run.
Okay.
But we had been told before, when I completed my 30-minute mission, I was told, you're not going to rotate back to the States because all eastbound transportation had been frozen, anticipating the invasion of Japan in November. And therefore, we're not allowing any eastbound releases at this time. So, I sit there, and then the two bombs were dropped, and they opened it up.
Now, when did you find out about the atomic weapon having been dropped? Was it the day?
I think it was probably either the day or the next day, and so much speculation around what in the world is an atomic bomb, and it went all the way from being capsule the co-pilot throw out his window to being a huge thing like it really was.
Wow.
One navigator that was in our wing group, I think, had a buddy on Tinian. Mm-hmm. It was in the 509th. Mm-hmm. And he went over there one day on some kind of transport just to visit his buddy. And they wouldn't let him get even close to the airplanes. But the navigator of in that group, 509th, told him, he says, It's a completely different configurated airplane. So when he came back, he says, I don't know what they're doing over there, but it's something very unusual. So once they dropped it, and he had told us about the very environment, we kind of assumed it was a big thing. No. But we didn't know what the power meant at that time. Never heard of megatons.
Never heard of megatons.
I'd never heard of megatons.
What was your reaction? The fact that you didn't know, you probably couldn't visualize it.
When we heard about it officially and heard what it had done, wow, one bomb does all of that.
Right.
And then we heard about Nagasaki and wow. But you know what? We being our nation, and not all of the nation, being the ones who protest the use of the two atomic weapons over there, and criticizing the killing of the number of people that those two bombs did, we killed a lot more people than that with our just regular bombing and fire raids. 15% of Tokyo taken out on one raid. Think how many, I don't remember how many people advertised taken out, but it was equivalent to what Hiroshima was.
Or more.
Mm-hmm. Nobody screamed about that. Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that, Jim?
I don't know. I don't understand why people would try to take apples versus oranges when they're both apples, killing people. And I had no compunction about the people I killed. Doesn't bother me in the least today. Mm-hmm. Because we were doing it for a good cause that kept our nation and possibly a lot of the world free from that authoritarian dictatorship that was over there.
Now, let me just shift for a second and ask Minnie Mae, what did you, were you getting letters from him?
Every day.
Every day?
Almost every day. When he was able.
Do you still have those letters?
Part of them. I saved nearly all of them. I don't know how many we have, but a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they didn't come every day. Sometimes they would be two or three in a day, and maybe not.
They'd bunch up. Because
but now people call each other. You know, I have a friend whose son is in Korea. Yeah. He calls his wife all the time.
Yeah, can you even imagine?
No. Because we were so excited when we got a letter.
I'm sure you must have been.
You must have been. I'll take the time flying back from the target, back to Guam, 7-8 hours. I'd take time to write her letter.
Because and you would let the co-pilot just kind of manage things while you would?
Well, we had no autopilot. Okay. And what needs the co-pilot and I would take naps on the way home. Mm-hmm. So
you'd write her a letter?
Right.
That was time well spent, I think.
I think I would tell her about your lunches. This is funny.
Oh, this is awesome.
Well, that's all right. That's right.
When we started flying our missions, we'd get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in a little sack. Mm-hmm. And it gives maybe a big can of some kind of juice, which had to split among, or maybe it was two of those or three, I don't remember, to split among the crew. But each person just got one peanut butter jelly sandwich for 16, 17, 18 hour mission.
I can't imagine.
And we complained to the group commander in our pre-flight briefings, and he went to the we call it mess officer, the dining officer, one day, food service officer, and said, either they're going to get adequate flight lunches. No, he didn't say that. He said, I've cautioned you about getting some adequate flight lunches. You're scheduled for a combat mission with crew such and such tomorrow.
That got him motivated.
So when he got back from that mission, we began to get bologna sandwiches, spam sandwiches.
So did you get enough so that you could have maybe a little snack as well?
We got
a little bit more extra.
Yeah, I forgot now what else. Something else that was canned. But that was far remove the flight lunches you get today when you make a flight in the military airplane.
I can imagine. Poor guys. Well, let's take a break there.
Okay.